All right, so this is Bio 231, Human Anatomy. We're going to finish up axial skeleton, move on to appendicular skeleton today. All right, so I was just showing you the video on the skull bones that you can practice. It's what? It's sort of a tutorial, but it's sort of a quiz, too, sort of a self-assessment for yourself. You don't necessarily have time to write the answer down to check your spelling, but I think I was paying attention to what I was doing when I made it, and the spelling should be correct on the on the annotations underneath the figures, and you should all be able to find, all right, this is the website, sem.cypresscollege.edu/JGober, and here it is. All right, so you should be able to help yourself with that. Okay, so before we finish up axial skeleton, you should be able to draw out from a superior view looking into the cranial vault all of the foramina that act as a passageway from the exterior skull to the inside. All right, so how long would it take you to draw such an item, you think? Naming and labeling, positioning all the foramina and labeling them. Long time? Well, you got to get it down. So let's just see if I can remember how to do it. All right, so is that dark enough right there? I might run out of ink. All right, so that is looking superiorly into the cranial vault. So this is what, anterior? And here is posterior. And in this region right here, we have a bunch of little foramina. Those are the olfactory foramina. And you should know what bone that is. You should probably know what that other line that I drew right there is. That's the crista galli that's in the ethmoid bone. So this is what? The olfactory foramina. Foramina, like that. All right, then what's going to be, so let's just go from anterior to posterior. What's going to be the next foramen? And it's probably going to be about in this location here and here. Optic canal. All right, optic canal. All right, I'm glad you guys are giving me some help because I don't know if I can remember this. Optic canal. And then from there, we're going to move just a little bit lateral. Okay. And what the heck is that one going to be? Okay. Okay, it's going to look like that. And then the next one is going to look like that. And then there's going to be one that looks like that. Okay. So let's write these down. These are... foramen rotundum, all right, and foramen ovale, and then foramen spinosum. All right, and about in this region right here, there's going to be a big ridge, a big prominent ridge that sticks up into the cranial vault. That's the petrous region of the temporal bone that has all of the apparatus for hearing and equilibrium inside the temporal bones. And then you drop down from that ridge right there, and there is something right about there, which is called the foramen lucerum. Get your pictures out, is that right? Foramen lucerum? Huh? Lacerum. All right, just checking. Foramen lacerum. All right, then from foramen lacerum, there's something else, right about maybe here. And it's going to be equidistant with another hole that's right on the outside. So this is the, and I'm going to just label it now on the inside just a little bit. This is the internal acoustic meatus. All right, and then over here is going to be the external acoustic meatus or auditory meatus. And of course, it's not patent. You can't go from the outside of your cranium to your brain because that petrous region of the temporal bone is right there. And all right, so that's that. Now we're getting really close. We're getting really close to being done. We got two more foramina to look at. There's this one. All right, foramen Magnum, that one's easy. And then there's another little one right about here. That's the hypoglossal canal, right? Hypoglossal canal. And that's pretty good, yeah. Oh, I'll show you where that carotid is in just a second. Okay, oh yeah, jugular. Jugular is about maybe here. Jugular's big. All right, jugular foramen. Yeah. You know, it's a little bit variable. Sometimes you might even find it within the foramen magnum on the side of the wall. Other times it's going to be more on the superior surface of the occipital bone right here. Yeah. So it's going to be, there's a little bit of variation in that one. Yeah, it could actually be inside the foramen magnum over here. It all just depends. Okay. So there was something else that somebody asked, and that's the carotid canal. All right, so when you say canal, is it just a really thin, narrow hole, or is it an elongated tunnel sort of object? It's more like a tunnel, right? A canal is more like a tunnel. And we can't see it from the anterior view, right? And it's really hard to see in a lot of the bones that we have in lab unless it's been drilled out. And most of the skulls have been drilled out. The carotid canal is going to be, if you look from the inferior side of the skull looking up, not looking down into, it's going to be right about here. All right, and then what it does, it projects up into the temporal bone a little ways and then makes a curve inside the temporal bone and moves over to foramen lacerum. So it moves in this direction and enters the cranium at about the same spot that foramen lacerum does. All right, so you might be able to see it really good from the inferior view, and if you had a pipe cleaner, you could thread it through, right? You can make all those twists and turns to see where it enters right up over here. So it's a little bit of a difficult object to see. All right, so on the test, the exam figures in lecture only contain what, the superior view. I don't have the inferior view. All right, so you can see I was a little bit rusty on that. You shouldn't be rusty like that for the practicum. I would guess you should be able to draw this out, label it in about maybe 30 seconds if you practice it enough. Okay? All right, so did we miss anything? Olfactory foramina, optic canal, rotundum, ovalis spinosum, lacerum. Internal acoustic meata, external, jugular foramen, hypoglossal, and foramen magnum. Okay? So you should have some pictures of that, like, in your mind, right? Recognizing things on a practicum really easy if you draw it out. So who's drawing stuff out in lab? Did anybody get any quizzes in lab where you actually have to draw something? No? Okay. I made that recommendation, and I think that would help you guys to actually draw these things out a bunch. All right. Now, you are getting little quizzes in lab. Hopefully they're fun and just give you some positive reinforcement, so that you can pick this stuff up. Yeah. SI. Oh, that's right. When is your SI on Friday? Is it in the afternoon?
Yeah. Uh-oh. Friday.
Oh. Okay. Good. Then it doesn't conflict too much. It's just that I have meetings all day long in the morning, so I can't hold open lab in the morning. Okay. So that's an okay time. All right. So that's the foramina. So let's see, where did we leave off last time? We're somewhere near the thoracic cage, I believe. Okay. We're done with the thoracic cage? We ended at the vertebral column. Oh yeah, that's part of the thoracic cage. Okay, so do you wish to say anything to the class regarding SI?
Just let everybody know that we had SI this morning, and you only have 2 weeks left for the exam, and that we're going to have a free test next, not this Friday, next Friday, as usual. Everybody's welcome, and good luck studying.
I have a question, but sometimes I can't make it until like 8:30.
You can come in. I have people up in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, you can come in late.
Yeah.
It's pretty open going.
But
yeah,
no.
Three 318 or 308. These are the room numbers for SI. 318 Monday, Wednesday. Room number 318 Monday, Wednesday. Room 308 on Friday. So it does switch on Friday. Okay. Vertebral column. All right, so let's go to some pictures and start to look at the vertebral column. All right, you're familiar with all these bones, cavities. So here's the vertebral column. And what's the job of the vertebral column?
Support.
Support. Support your body. All your body weight is resting on the vertebrae. And another important function of the vertebral column, just like your cranium protects your brain, the vertebral column protects your spinal cord. And so that's very soft tissue. It needs a lot of protection as well. And you can see that the vertebral column is made up of individual vertebrae, and there are different divisions that these vertebrae belong to. The most superior division is the cervical region. The next one is the thoracic region. The next lower is the lumbar, and then we have sacral and then the coccygeal vertebrae. All right, so you got to remember there are 7 cervical vertebrae, 12 thoracic, and 5 lumbar. And the sacral is a little bit variable. It could be, it's usually about 5, but the coccygeal, that's a highly variable region. That could be anywhere from 3 to 5, maybe even 6 in some individuals. The thoracic vertebrae is usually 12, but there might be somebody in here that only has 11. There's some variability in that region, but it's not very often that we find it. Okay, so how are you going to remember that there are 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, and 5 lumbar if you're not good? Yeah, meal times. Like you have breakfast at 7, you have lunch at noon, you have dinner at 5 o'clock. All right, hopefully it's close to that time. All right, but that's when most people have those meals. So it's easy to remember how many are in this division. Okay, we see some curvatures of the spine in general. Here we can see the cervical curvature, and this is an anterior bend to the spine. This just helps position the weight of the head over the center of the body for balance. All right, and then we see a thoracic curvature, and you can see that's a posterior curvature right here. And so that's an indentation in the vertebral column, because what do you got in this region right here? Anterior to that, yeah, you have all of the organs in the thorax, the lungs and the heart. And so you need some space, right, to put all those organs. So that's the thoracic curvature right here. And then the lumbar curvature deviates anteriorly again to reposition weight over the center of mass of your body so that you have balance. And then the last curvature is the sacral curvature right here, which is a posterior curvature, again, for the same reason why the thoracic curvature is posterior, and that is, this is making room for a bunch of important organs in that part of your body, okay? You know, I don't think about it in terms of this convex, concave curvature. I just say, you know, posterior or anterior, and it just makes a whole lot more sense to me, okay? Yeah. Good question. You know, and I never learned it because it all depends on how you look at. I don't know what anatomical position is for this concave, convex terminology. Okay. 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 So, all right. But another thing to think about is, why do you have 12 thoracic vertebrae? Okay. And that is due to the definition of the thoracic vertebrae. All right, let me see what I got right here. All right, here we go. Okay, so your thoracic cage extends posteriorly from the vertebrae, okay, and includes the ribs and then anteriorly the sternum right here. And when you look at this slide right here, how many ribs do you see?
12.
You actually see that there are 12, right? And they attach to a vertebrae right here. So since you have 12 ribs, you have to have 12 thoracic vertebrae. That's the definition of a thoracic vertebrae. There has to be a rib articulating with it. If there is a vertebrae with no articulation to a rib, then can it be a thoracic vertebra? It can't be, right? So it's just a one-to-one correspondence. If somebody, because of anatomic variation, only has 11 ribs, how many vertebrae do they have? How many thoracic vertebrae do they have? They only have 11, right? So there's always a one-to-one correspondence. Okay? So that's a thoracic vertebrae. The cervical vertebrae, all right, in this region right here, are kind of special. You should know some distinguishing features that separate or distinguish cervical vertebrae from all the other vertebrae. And cervical vertebrae have these transverse foramina in the transverse processes, right? And so there is a vertebral artery and a vertebral vein that course through these foramina right here that are taking blood to the brain. They're going, or blood back down from the brain, right, through these vertebrae right here. And only cervical vertebrae have the transverse foramina. That's the only kind. This one right here is a cervical vertebrae because you can see the transverse foramen, but it's also a special one because you see that it doesn't have a body right here. There's no vertebral body to it. It just looks like a ring and it's pretty narrow. This is the first cervical vertebrae, and only the first two have special names associated with them. C1, or cervical 1, and hardly anybody ever says cervical. We just abbreviate it by saying C1. C1 has got the name of the Atlas, because that's the mythological Greek, I believe, figure that is holding up the world. Somebody had to be holding up the world, and Atlas was, that was the job of Atlas to do that. And so since this is holding up the head, we call that the Atlas, all right, or C1. So you can see the superior articulating facet. This articulates with what bone of the skull? The occipital bone, and the occipital bone has condyles right there that articulate with the superior articulating facets on the Atlas. The second cervical vertebrae, or axis, all right, is this one right here. All right, so you can, so this is anterior, here is posterior, here's the spinous process, right? The spinous process is always projecting posterior off of the vertebrae, no matter what vertebrae it is. This is the body of a vertebrae, and notice what is attached to the superior aspect of the body of C2. It is the den, sometimes we call it the odontoid process, but what that really is what the body of C1 that has been relocated to the body of C2, right? So that's where the body of C1 ended up. And this forms a special kind of articulation. Do I have a picture of that? Here's a pretty good picture of it. All right, so here is the axis. That's the name for C2, right? And here is the atlas. Here's C1. And we can see that the dens is poking up and is held in position by this transverse ligament. All right, so this is a very special joint between C1 and C2, and it allows for rotation of the cervical spine. So rotation is going to be a right or left rotation. It's going to be this kind of motion. Right, that's like your least favorite answer ever. All right, that's the no motion. That happens only between C1 and C2. But what other motion can you do with your head? Okay? You can perform flexion and extension, right? And that cannot occur between C1 and C2, but that occurs between the occipital bone and C1. That rocking kind of motion. That's the yes motion. That's everybody's favorite answer. All right, so if you try to rotate between C1 and the occipital bone, something's going to break. And of course, that's not a very good thing when you break any kind of vertebrae, all right, in your body, especially that high. And rotation is only allowed between C1 and C2. So if you try to flex at that particular joint, something else is going to break there as well. And so it's very common to get some kind of whiplash injuries where you might actually fracture C1 right in this location. And you have to be very careful. That can be a nice stable fracture, right, as long as you get to the hospital and that neck then is immobilized until that vertebrae is healed. How long does that take to heal? 4 to 5 weeks, something like that. But since this is such a tenuous location, somebody might be immobilized for a little bit longer time just to make sure everything is healing properly. And it probably will be followed with x-ray as it does heal. Okay. Now, if there is a fracture of C2, which is, if there's a fracture of C2, what usually happens is that the dens breaks off. All right, and that's terrible. That's not a stable fracture. The dens has a propensity to go right into the spinal cord, right? And then somebody's paralyzed from that level down. That would produce what? Quadriplegic. Okay, so certainly, so between C1 and C2, rotation is allowed, but not flexion and extension, which is a yes kind of motion right here. Another characteristic of a cervical vertebrae is that the spinous process is going to be bifid. That means that it's going to have two points coming off of it. So that's another dead giveaway. All right, so cervical vertebrae, even the people in the back row up over there, probably if I were to hold up a cervical vertebrae from down here, you could probably tell that it's a cervical vertebrae from way far away because of why? The transverse foramina and this bifid spinous process. Well, maybe not the back row, but close. Okay, because sometimes this is are worn off and they're hard to see. Okay. A good diagram, talking about just being able to draw things out, is this diagram right here. You should probably just draw this one from memory. This is just a typical vertebrae, and you can see a typical vertebrae has a body or a centrum right here. It's got this spinous process. It's got these two transverse processes, and this is the vertebral foramen for the spinal cord. The armor plating that makes up the vertebral foramen anteriorly is the body of the vertebrae, and then coming off the body are the two pedicles here and here, right? And then the coming off the pedicles are the lamina, right? And if we put a lamina and a pedicle together, that forms about half of the vertebral foramen right here. That's what we call the vertebral arch, and that's what protects the spinal cord. So we put these two vertebral arches together along with the body right here that makes the whole vertebral foramen. All right, but you see some little depressions that are kind of have like a little blue color to them. Is that blue?
Yeah.
Gray? Gray. Okay, gray. All right, so these are going to be smooth surfaces. These are articulating surfaces, right? And these sometimes are very difficult to see, but you should be able to feel them with your fingertips. So what is a smooth surface used for on a bone? It's going to be for an articulation, right? So an articulation is a bone-to-bone connection, and they're covered in a healthy vertebrae with cartilage, and that's why they're given that little color right there. All right, so this superior articulating facet is going to articulate with the inferior articulating facet on the superior vertebrae, and there is an inferior articulating surface or facet underneath the pedicle that we can't see in this projection, right? So make sure in lab you actually put two vertebrae together and see how they articulate and how they fit together very nicely. Okay, so make sure you can see these articulating or these joints between the superior articulating process and the inferior articulating process of the superior vertebrae. The other two articulating surfaces we see are on the transverse process over here. And we don't find this on all vertebrae, just a couple. Which ones have this transverse articulating surface right here? The thoracic vertebrae, right? So that's what's going to help hold a rib in position. Well, we haven't looked at a rib yet, but the rib, one end of the rib is called the head of the rib, and that's going to articulate on the body of a vertebrae, a body of a thoracic vertebrae. And it's going to articulate actually between two of them, an inferior and a superior one. So these sometimes we call demifacets because it takes two of these to accommodate the head of one rib. Okay, and so we don't really call that a facet. Usually we call that a demifacet. So again, in lab, make sure you go over to the skeleton and see how that rib, the head of the rib, articulates between these two vertebral bodies. All right, and then the other part of a rib is going to articulate right here. That's going to be the conoid tubercle, on a rib, or a tubercle of a rib is going to articulate with this transverse process right before it courses around anteriorly. Right, so the rib is going to come in like this. The head articulating here, the conoid tubercle here, and then it's going to form the thoracic cavity. So make sure you know this is the body, right? This is the pedicle, this is the lamina, and this terminology has to be very specific because, as you can imagine, there is a lot of pathology with different vertebrae due to osteoporosis or trauma, right? Vertebrae fail at different locations, and we got to be very precise in describing where that failure occurs. It could be in the body, for instance, or it could be in the pedicle, or it could be a lamina, or it could be, you know, a crushing injury that destroys the whole vertebrae. Okay. Between vertebrae, there is some fibrocartilage. There's a fibrocartilaginous ring, which we call the annulus fibrosus. All right, and then in the center, there's more of a jelly-like material called the nucleus pulposus of the disc, and the fibrosis, that's fibrocartilage, usually holds the pulposus in position, but if there's damage to the fibrosis, then this jelly-like material can leak out. Typically, it likes to leak out posteriorly, and when that does, that impinges on a nerve that's trying to leave the spinal cord to innervate some part of your body. So there's one more foramen that we have to view. All right, so we looked at the transverse foramina. And what kind of vertebrae has a transverse foramen? The cervical. And all of them have the vertebral foramen for the vertebral canal. But there is another foramen that we should be able to identify, but we can't see it on just a single vertebrae. We actually have to put a couple of them together, and definitely you should do this in lab two or walk over to the skeleton and see it. And these are what we call the intervertebral foramen, right? So here's one right here, and here's another one. Let me zoom in. Can you see maybe a little bit better? So here, intervertebral foramen, that is a hole where a spinal nerve leaves the vertebral column. And that foramen only appears as if you put two vertebrae together to form that particular foramen, right? So this is the hole that gets plugged up sometimes when you have a herniated intervertebral disc, all right, and impinges that nerve that's coming out through this intervertebral foramen. Okay, any question about that? Where do you find that? That you can't really illustrate if you just are holding one vertebrae. Okay. All right, now thoracic vertebrae, what do they look like? How can you tell a thoracic vertebrae from any other kind of vertebrae? Yeah. Okay, so a distinguishing feature would be the spinous process is very long and narrow, and it is angulated inferiorly. All right, so it's not bifurcated. The transverse processes don't have any foramina, but the spinous process is angulated inferiorly. It's very, very sharp. And also, the thoracic vertebrae are the only vertebrae that have what other bones attached to them? The ribs, right? So thoracic vertebrae have demifacets and it also has the transverse facet for the conoid tubercle. So you can find articulations for ribs. Can I see them on this slide right here? Oh, maybe, yeah, here's the transverse costal facet for the tubercle of a rib, and I can't really see the body well enough to find where the demifacet is for the head of a rib. All right, but this is a nice slide because now you can see the superior articulating process and surface as well as the, what, inferior articulating process and surface on that same vertebrae. All right, so how many joints do you see on these different vertebrae right here? Do you see a lot of joints? I mean, before you took an anatomy class, could you appreciate how many joints there were between vertebrae and between ribs, for instance? All right, so here's a couple joints right here, another couple down over here, this big strong joint right over here, and then you got joints for the ribs, and all these joints have pain receptors. All right, so if these joints aren't working properly, it's really not unrealistic to expect that somebody's going to experience a lot of pain because each junction between each of the vertebrae just have so many joints between them, okay? And back problems or back pain is very prevalent because of that. All right, so these ribs right here are typical of lumbar. I'm sorry, these vertebrae are typical of lumbar vertebrae. And what the distinguishing feature of a lumbar vertebrae is that the spinous process is not angulated and it's very square. It's not very, it's not pointed in any way. It doesn't have any articulations for ribs, and the vertebral bodies are huge to support the weight of the individual. Right, so those are some distinguishing features of lumbar vertebrae. All right, how many lumbar vertebrae does a normal person have? Got five. That's right. Okay. All right, five lumbar. Ah, then the sacrum. This one is maybe a little bit more complicated. All right, but you see that it has a number of vertebrae that are fused, and these correspond to the, what, the intervertebral foramina. This is where spinal nerves leave the spinal cord and come out to the body. And depending on what aspect of the sacrum you look at, it has a different name, even though it's the same whole. Since this is the anterior view right here, these are what we call the anterior sacral foramina. All right, so if you look at the anterior view, it's going to kind of look like a cup like that. All right, but if you look at the posterior view, you see the same holes, but these we call the posterior sacral foramina. And you might wonder, well, why do they have two different names? And that's because there are nerves that go in two different directions depending on when they leave the spinal cord, right? The ones that are going to your back at this region right here, all right, exit the sacrum through the posterior sacral foramina and go posterior, but ones that are going into the pelvic cavity exit the sacrum via the anterior sacral foramina. All right, so things are really leaving the spinal canal, which is what we call the sacral canal in this region right here. They're not really passing from anterior to posterior of the sacrum. There's nothing really passing through the sacrum. They're just spinal nerves leaving the sacral canal. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. All right, and then the coccyx right here, that's just a vestigial organ. I don't know of any important functions. I don't have any nerves that leave right through here. But it probably hurts like hell if you break it, so you do have to be kind to the coccygeal vertebrae.
Is there any support function or like balance function?
For the coccyx?
Yeah.
No, not in us. But in the cat, for instance. Can I remember? We used to, yeah, the tail. I think the cat has 26 coccygeal vertebrae. Okay, so it's important for them. So other mammals, the coccygeal vertebrae are very important.
Okay.
That used to be the tail before we lost our tail. Yeah. Okay, so this could be what? Used as evidence of evolution, of having some kind of common ancestor. Okay, the thoracic cage. Made up of the thoracic vertebrae, the ribs, and the sternum. And of course, since we have 12 thoracic vertebrae, we got 12 ribs, but we can group them into some categories. The ribs that attach directly to the sternum via costal cartilage right here, we call a true rib. Right? And ribs 1 through 7 are true ribs. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All right, and you might be wondering, this is an okay diagram to see this. You might be wondering, why is number 7 a true rib? Because it looks all confused in terms of the cartilage connections right here. But let me outline what that cartilage connection is. All right, so let me just make sure I get this right. All right, so one, take a look at rib number 1 in lab. It looks strange, right? It's flat, and it might actually maybe look like part of a hyoid bone or something strange. So you got to develop a little bit of an eye to recognize this first rib. 1, 2, 3, 4. And here you can see the cartilage going directly to the sternum. 5, directly to the sternum. 6, directly to the sternum. And then here is the cartilage for rib number 7 going right here. All right, so you can see that rib number 7 articulates via the costal cartilage directly to the body of the sternum. And then rib number 8, which is this one right here, it has a costal cartilage, but where does it go to? Yeah, it goes through the cartilage of rib number 7, not through the sternum. All right, so develop a little bit of an eye for that too. As well as, all right. All right, the last two. These last two, notice, there are no costal cartilages whatsoever. All right, so these are what we call floating ribs. They have no cartilage on them. Yes? This one right here? I think maybe that's just a transverse process. Okay? That's part of just a transverse process, I believe. Okay? So here is rib number 1. Okay? So we've got 7 true ribs. All right? And then we got 5 false ribs. All right? But remember, the inferior 2 false ribs are also called floating ribs because they don't have any cartilage on them. All right, and you should know why these are called false ribs. Because they attach indirectly to the sternum via a costal cartilage of the 7th true rib right there. All right, so what does a rib look like? Here's a rib. Most of the ribs pretty much look like this. Here's the head. Here's the conoid tubercle of the rib. So the head, you can see, articulates with the 2 demifacets on the body of the thoracic vertebrae. Yeah? Why is the xiphoid, in the previous slide, why does it look like cartilage? Probably because somebody was diagramming a pre-pubertal individual. All right, so before somebody is an adult, the xiphoid process is cartilage. But as you get older, that cartilage turns more and more and more into bone. Okay, so it just depends on what age that individual was. The function of that xiphoid process right there, it's just... you know, I don't really know the evolution of that little piece of bone right there, but there is a muscle that attaches, that inserts right into that region right there, and it's the abdominal muscle, so it acts as an attachment point to the rectus abdominis, as well as the body of the sternum. Okay, so it just helps some abdominal muscles to do their job. Okay, so here's the head of the rib, the tubercle. Then you can see it courses posteriorly, and then it bends back anteriorly, so that's the angle of a rib. And I don't know if we deleted this from your study sheet in lab or not, and it's called the costal groove. Okay, is that still in there? Okay, the costal groove, and I think I... left it in there because a lot of times in bones there are things that you can't see, but there are things that you can feel with your fingertips. You actually have better discrimination with your fingertips than you can with your vision, and you can actually palpate this costal groove right here, this little indentation in the medial aspect of the rib, very easily with your fingertips, which might be really hard to see depending on the lighting conditions. Alright, so that's sort of interesting, and you should palpate bones to feel what is articulating surface, what is a process for muscle attachment, because there's a lot you can tell just with your fingertips. Okay, so I think that's pretty much it. Oh, and here's a shaft of a rib right here. Okay, and you can see the articulation, okay, with the demifacet, with the head, the conoid tubercle, with the articulating facet of the transverse process. All right, and look at all the marrow that can be contained in ribs because of the spongy bone. Typically, it's red marrow. And red marrow in the sternum as well. Oh, I didn't say something about the sternum. The sternum has some pieces to it, some parts. All right, what are the parts to the sternum? You've got that xiphoid process right there that does ossify as we get older. And then here's the body of the sternum, and here's the manubrium. All right, and the sternal angle, if you look at the sternum, you can see that the manubrium and sternum have a little bit of an angle, and so it pokes out right about here, jugular notch and the clavicular notch right here. These are depressions in the manubrium. All right, and the sternum is pretty important, for instance, if somebody goes into cardiac arrest, because what can we do with that sternum? Yeah, we can do chest compressions. We can compress that sternum and compress the heart. And when you compress the heart, that has a tendency to squish blood out of it, which is going to promote a little circulation in somebody that whose heart is not beating, and that can maintain somebody's life. So just kind of as a really quick aside, when somebody's heart stops beating, how long can they maintain consciousness? Okay, I don't know, did I talk to you about this yet in here? No, this is interesting. Because your brain is highly metabolic. It needs a lot of oxygen because there's organelles in the brain that make ATP. What are those organelles that make ATP again? Mitochondria. And in order for mitochondria to make ATP, they need oxygen. You cut off oxygen supply to mitochondria, they can't make ATP. So how long can you maintain consciousness without that ATP as an energy source for your brain? Okay. It is, a good ballpark is 3 seconds. Okay, probably most people don't even maintain consciousness that long. Okay, about 3 seconds, which is what, a really short period of time. All right, but your brain needs that energy not only to stay conscious, but to stay alive. After what period of time, after the heart stops, does your brain actually die? Okay, you go unconscious in 3 seconds and brain dead after 3 minutes. All right, there's a range. It's maybe 2 to 5, something like that. All right, so how can we extend that period of time for somebody so that their brain doesn't die in just 3 minutes? That's called, CPR. You do those chest compressions on the sternum right there, and that keeps a little circulation, bringing enough oxygen to their brain for them to stay alive. They might not come back to consciousness, of course, but that might be enough to keep their brain alive until somebody can start their heart up again. All right, so... Well, CPR is to do chest compressions. That means that somebody is actually like pumping somebody's heart when that person's heart is not beating on their own. Okay, so CPR, only certain training, maybe you can be trained to start somebody's heart up again, but that is only when there's special devices available, and it's called an automatic electronic defibrillator. And I don't know if there's any on campus. There might be one in the health service. Okay. So who can run really fast in here? Raise your hand. So if somebody in here passes out, you're designated to run to the health service and get that AED and bring it back fast. Because you only have a couple minutes, right, to start somebody's heart again. So you're doing chest compressions only as an intermediary technique, all right, to save somebody until actually somebody can start their heart up again. All right, so that's a pretty tenuous position to be in. Yeah.
So, if you're doing CPR for like 15 minutes, are you still brain dead?
You know, it all kind of depends on the person and how well it is, you know, how well it's going. You can also do rescue breathing, yeah, back and forth. But you know what? I don't know if one person, unless you're an athlete and you exercise regularly, I don't know if you could do chest compressions by yourself for 15 minutes. I think you'd almost get a heart attack as well, okay? Because it's a lot of work to do that. All right, but now, for instance, for me, all right, if all of a sudden my heart stops, all right, I don't want you to stop after 15 minutes because there's enough of you here to trade off. My brain isn't going to die for at least 2 hours. All right, so you make sure you keep doing those chest compressions until somebody tells you to stop, and then you're going to turn around and say, are you sure? Okay, and then you can stop after that. But yeah, no, it's really tough. It's tough. Yeah.
What's the ratio again?
You know, it kind of changed the ratio from chest compressions to breathing. It changes quite a bit. It's interesting. But what is it right now? Does anybody know? Okay, 2 to 15. It used to be a lot more breathing than 2. But we've kind of realized that's sort of a waste of time because when we get into the cardiovascular system, we'll see there's only one place where oxygen can actually leave the blood. It can't leave from an artery, can't leave from a vein, it can only leave from a capillary. So all that blood that's in your arteries has plenty of oxygen to keep your brain alive, right? You just need to get it to the brain. And so if you waste a lot of time breathing for somebody, then you're subtracting from the time that blood it's actually pumped to the brain. So now pumping is a lot more advantageous than actually breathing for somebody because your blood is already loaded up with a lot of oxygen. I'll try to mention that again when we get into CPR. But that's the rationale for that. Oh, and the reason why I got off on this tangent, sorry about that. Huh? Yeah, I didn't quite hear, but there's one other thing. Don't forget about what you're saying. Okay, one other thing. This is why I got off onto that tangent. Because this little bone right here, namely the xiphoid process, right, is the articulation is very, very weak, and it is bony, probably in everybody here. It is ossified, and when you fracture a bone, it's very sharp. It's not quite like a broken piece of glass, but nonetheless, it's very, very sharp. And if you're doing chest compressions down over here, you can break off that xiphoid process, and it can be forced into deeper organs, right? Maybe like the liver, for instance, or other organs. And so now that doesn't help the patient very much, because now they have massive hemorrhaging inside their body as well as a stopped heart, right? So when you do chest compressions, definitely you want to do it on the body of the sternum. So you should make some measurements, right? Okay. And then, of course, depending on the age of the individual, you need other training. If it's a pediatric patient or an infant, right, that's additional specialties, yeah. Now, I'm not quite sure if I heard.
I thought you were referring, first of all, about the sternum rub, like when a person is unconscious.
The sternal rub?
Yeah.
I've not even heard of that.
Well, I've seen it done. Yeah. My son back to life, and he was out, and yeah. He did sternum rub, and he woke up.
Okay.
If
you see the person go unconscious, you can do that? Is that the... Okay. There used to be something called pericardial thump, too.
Yeah.
Which is never... It's not recommended anymore. But for me, try it. Okay? Try the pericardial thump, do the sternal rub, do the earlobe slap, whatever. Okay? And maybe there's... and maybe there's some other things, too, that I could... that I would recommend that you do that aren't in CPR manual. Okay. All right, so talking about infant and pediatric CPR, I don't know if this is an exam figure for you, but you do have to know this for the practicum, okay? And these are the fontanelles in the neonate skull. And fontanelles are the unossified joints between the major parts of the major bones of the cranium. And these are important because... the brain tissue actually grows a whole lot faster than bone tissue does in the newborn. And so if the cranial vault was completely ossified at birth, right, the brain would have no place to grow and expand. So these joints, which we call fontanelles, allow for rapid expansion of the cranial vault that matches the speed at which a person's brain develops in the first couple of years of life. All right, but that also means, though, that since this is a cartilaginous or fibrous joint between these plates of the skull, right, it's not as hard as the bone itself. And so an infant's brain can be damaged very easily, right, by different kinds of manipulations, not just trauma to the head. Right? And so does anybody know how long these fontanelles can actually last for?
2 years.
Yeah, 2 years. That's a really long time. Really, really long time for a newborn. All right, so here is the anterior fontanelle, the mastoidal fontanelle, the sphenoidal fontanelle. So make sure you take a look at this neonate skull in lab. I think we have a couple models up there. All right, and you can also tell, look at this jawbone right here. Kind of looks like a geriatric patient. What kind of patient is a person is a geriatric person? Old person, right? And typically what happens, maybe I mentioned this before, typically what happens, we lose our teeth as we get older. And what bone holds your lower teeth in position?
The
mandible, right? And so now you don't have teeth pushing and pulling on the mandible. What happens to a bone when you stop exercising it? What happens to a muscle if you stop exercising it? It atrophies, it goes away. All right, so what happens to a muscle when you exercise it? It gets bigger and stronger. Same thing for bones, right? So if you exercise a bone, it will get bigger and stronger. And when somebody loses their teeth, this mandible has a tendency to dissolve away because it doesn't experience the same kind of normal stresses that somebody that has a full dentition. And that's what happens to the mandible with age. And maybe I mentioned this last time, that's why tooth transplants are kind of looked favorably right now. If you're missing a tooth, they'll actually transplant a prosthetic device into the mandible. and that stresses the mandible, and that maintains what the normal characteristics of that mandible. It preserves a bone density of the mandible. That's better than dentures, but probably really expensive. Okay. All right, so guess what? That's it for this chapter, which means that we're going to go to the appendicular skeleton. All right, so let me close some of these things down. What's on the practicum? Does the practicum have appendicular skeleton on it? Probably. All right, so before we start looking at the appendicular skeleton, oh, actually, I should have showed you that the picture of the whole skeleton before I moved on to this chapter. So kind of in your mind, make sure you can separate bones of the axial skeleton from the appendicular skeleton. All right? And so axial skeleton is what? Head, vertebral column, thoracic cage. That's axial skeleton. Did I say that right? Axial skeleton. All right, appendicular skeleton is what? Bones of the upper appendage, lower appendage, plus bones, yeah, the girdles that help attach your appendages to your axial skeleton. All right, so the girdle that attaches your upper appendage is made up of two bones.
They had a question on this side today.
Yeah?
The hyoid bone was part of the axial skeleton.
It's part of the axial skeleton. Where's that hyoid bone? Way up in here someplace. Yeah, that's axial skeleton.
But it's not connected to
anything. It is what we call floating. Yeah. We don't have many floating bones in the human skeleton, but other animals do. It's fairly common in other kinds, like cats. They're clavicle floats. It's not articulating. So what can you tell me about the dexterity of a cat upper appendage? Oh, man, it can do all kinds of things. More range of motion even than humans because their bones aren't as tightly packed together up there. They have a floating clavicle.
Is that the reason why cats squish
to do what?
Is that the reason they squish very
easy? Oh, because they can just squish right down. We can't with our shoulders because our clavicles are tightly wedged in to our sternum and our scapula, which we'll see right here. Yeah. Okay, so this right here is what we call the pectoral girdle. Pectoral girdle attaches the upper appendage to your axial skeleton. And the pectoral girdle is composed of the scapula and the clavicle. And you can see the humerus, which is the bone in the arm, articulates with the scapula, and then the scapula articulates with the clavicle. And notice that your whole upper appendage articulates with your axial skeleton at only one measly little joint right here. Okay? And that is the clavicular manubrial joint. That's the only joint that's holding your whole arm to your body. Fortunately, you have other things that are holding your arm to your body, and that is what? That is muscles, right? A lot of strong muscles. And we're not going to look at muscles today, however. Okay, so here is the clavicle, and you can see the clavicle has this S shape to it. And in lab, you have to know the clavicular end via the sternal end. And you can't see it on this diagram right here very well, but the sternal end, right here, kind of looks like the flare on a trumpet. All right, so if you look on the side of a trumpet, it kind of looks like that. But if you look on end, what does it look like? Kind of looks like a circle. All right, so the sternal end is very, very round like this. All right, if you look at the other end of the clavicle, it's going to look really flat, even if you look on it on edge. It's just going to look like a blade of a knife. That's what we call the acromial end. So the acromial end right here is really, really flat, and this one is flared in all directions. It kind of looks like a funnel. Okay, so here is the conoid tubercle. So these are important joints right here for ligaments and tendons. And let's see, what else do I want to say? The shape of the clavicle right here It's tightly wedged in between the manubrium and the acromial process of the scapula. So a lot of times when you have any kind of trauma, lateral trauma to the shoulder, this clavicle doesn't have any place to go because it's tightly wedged in. So when you fall and hit your shoulder, this clavicle has a tendency to fracture. Okay? And by the nature of the curvature right here, it always has a tendency to fracture anteriorly or project outside your body, which is really good, and it's probably life-saving, and it's probably why the bone has evolved like this. Because if we were to fracture inward, there are a number of very important arteries and veins and nerves, right, and it probably would be fatal. And so there is, since this is a clavicle right here, you could probably tell me the name of that huge artery that goes right underneath the clavicle. It's called the subclavian artery, subclavian vein. All right, so that's just another example of why it's really important to know your bones really well, because you learn what? So much else about anatomy when you understand the names of bones. Okay. All right, the scapula. All right, we see, how are you going to figure out which is a medial or lateral margin to this bone right here? Okay. Because how is your arm in position? What is your arm? What's the position of your arm compared to the scapula? Is it medial or lateral? It's going to be lateral, right? And so where the humerus attaches to the scapula is right here in this indentation. We call that the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity. So this is the lateral part of the scapula, and here is the medial part of the scapula. This little angle down here is the inferior angle. This is the top part, or superior angle. All right, so we got lateral, medial, inferior, superior. And then the other thing that you got to realize about the scapula is, what is the anterior part? What's the posterior part? And probably before you took anatomy, you could tell that this is the posterior part of the scapula, because here's a big bony prominence that you have in your back that you can palpate. All right, so this is the scapular spine. Right, that leads up to the acromion, and that's a process. So, what do you think? What's the function of this spine right here? Muscle attachment. Yeah, just anytime you see spine, you're just automatically going to say muscle attachment. Okay, the anterior part of the scapula right in here, that's just one big fossa. So we call that the subscapular fossa. But on the posterior side, inferior to the scapular spine is the infraspinous fossa, and superior to it is the supraspinous fossa. No, I don't know if I brought it with me. Let me take a look. All right, so let me ask you a couple of questions. There's some muscles, right, that are holding your arm to your body. Rats. I might not have brought it. Okay. Let's start one, though. Please, thank you. All right, so guess what the name of the muscle is in the subscapular fossa? That's the anterior part of the scapula. Okay, so here is the subscapular fossa. The muscle there is the subscapularis. All right, so another example of if you know the names of bones, you know a whole lot more already. There's a muscle right here in the infraspinous fossa. That's called the infraspinatus. There is a muscle in the supraspinous fossa right here. That's the supraspinatus. Right? So if you pay a lot of attention to your bones, you'll be doing really good when it comes to muscles. Okay. This is the tip of your shoulder, the acromion process. Underneath that is the coracoid process. It kind of looks like the beak of a crow. It's a lot more narrow. The glenoid cavity is for articulation with the head of the humerus. That's a ball and socket joint, so the glenoid cavity is really the socket part of the head of the humerus, which is the ball part of that joint. And subscapular notch right here. All right, so I think that kind of goes over everything about the scapula. So make sure you pick up a scapula, model it on your body to see how it fits. Pick it up, turn it around. You should be able to figure out if it's a right scapula or a left scapula very easily. Because what's a landmark? What's a lateral landmark? The glenoid cavity is lateral. What's a good inferior landmark? The inferior angle. And what's a good posterior landmark? The scapular spine. So you should be able to rotate it around and put it right on your body. Probably you should do that with all the bones in lab. Pick them up and then model it on yourself. Where does it fit? And I think that will help you understand a lot about those bones. All right, so that's the girdle. So here you can see the three main fossas again, right? The infraspinous fossa, here's the supraspinous fossa, right? And then the subscapular fossa right here. And there's that glenoid cavity. There is some soft tissue. If you look at the glenoid cavity, you see that it's not a very deep bowl, right? Compared to another socket that we're going to see for the hip. So this is a very shallow kind of bowl, but there's something that enlarges the depth of, or makes the depth of this bowl deeper, and it stabilizes the shoulder joint, and that's called the glenoid labrum. Right, so that's just some fibrocartilage on the inferior lip of the glenoid cavity that makes the socket a little bit deeper and stabilizes the shoulder. But since it's not as strong as bone, guess what can happen to it? It can tear and can rip, right? Especially like in baseball players. Right? It can rip that glenoid labrum, and a lot of times on TV you'll hear, oh yeah, they got a labral tear or lip or something of the labrum, and so now you know what they're talking about. It's just something that makes the glenoid cavity deeper. All right, so that's pectoral girdle. Are the bones of the upper appendage. Most proximal is the humerus, and you can see the head of the humerus. If you palpate the head of the humerus, what does it feel like? It should be smooth, because it's for articulation, right? It's an articulating surface. What is going to articulate with the head of the humerus right here? The glenoid cavity, right? And part of the labrum as well. Yeah. Rotator cuff is a structure that's composed of a number of muscles, four muscles, and some tendons and ligaments that are associated with those muscles. So I'm going to talk about rotator cuff, but not until we get to the muscle chapter. Yeah. So rotator cuff is real important, but it's going to be more pertinent to muscles than to bones. But of course, you got to remember your bone structure, because that's how the muscles attach to the various pieces and parts of these bones up here. Okay. There is usually a little narrowing from the diaphysis of the humerus by the time it gets up to the head. Right, and so here is a little narrowing right here, and any kind of little narrowing by the time you get to the head of something, we call that the neck. Right, so that's the neck of the humerus right there. Look in lab to see if you can see a little depression running around the head of the humerus. But it's still a pretty massive part of the bone. The humerus hardly ever fractures in that location. It has a tendency to fracture in this location over here. Right, so we call that the surgical neck as a result of that. So this is where most of the repairs have to be made. Then we got a couple tubercles on the proximal humerus. We got the lesser tubercle and the greater tubercle. And guess what the function of these tubercles is? You're always going to say muscle attachment, right? Because it's a rough bony prominence on a bone. And we'll maybe learn what some of, we'll learn what some muscles are that attach here. Some muscles that form the rotator cuff, for instance. And you can see a groove running between the tubercles, and that's the intertubercular groove or intertubercular sulcus. There's a big important tendon that runs right through there. That's a part of the tendon of the biceps muscle that runs right through there. And mid-diaphysis, we see the deltoid tuberosity. That's a rough raised area on the humerus right here. What's the function of the deltoid tuberosity? Muscle attachment. And guess what the name of the muscle is? Yeah, it's a deltoid muscle, and you probably all know where the deltoid muscle is, because that's where you get a lot of inoculations all the time, right? And that deltoid muscle right there, right? That's the insertion of the deltoid muscle. All right, then in the proximal humerus, we see a lot of really cool structures. that make up your elbow joint. So if you were to palpate this thing that kind of looks like a ball, we call that the capitulum, and this thing that kind of looks like a bobbin or a spool that you would wind some thread up on, all right, that's what we call the trochlea. If you were to palpate those with your fingertips, what would you notice? That it's really smooth, right? So that is, these are articulating surfaces. All right, so these are actually condyles. All right, a condyle is a smooth surface for articulation, but they're so special that we actually give them names. This is the capitulum and this is the trochlea right here. So make sure when you're in lab that you get a humerus and a couple of the bones that make up the forearm and put them together, and you'll see what a perfect fit they make. And once you see how those bones fit together, you probably won't ever forget the names of these structures right here. So let's talk a little bit about how the elbow joint is made. So these are the condylar surfaces. What do we have above a condyle? We have an epicondyle, right? So here's the, now, you do have to know medial and lateral on this bone, but again, it's pretty easy because you can always look at the head. Which way is the head going to be oriented? Medially or laterally? It's always got to be medial, right? So this whole aspect of the humerus is going to be medial, and this is lateral over here. Okay. Let's go, and I'm going to come back to this, but let's go to the bones that make up, what is this part of your anatomy again called? That's your forearm. All right, so you got two bones in the forearm. The lateral, which finger matches up with the lateral bone? Which finger is that? That is your? That's your thumb. Okay, your thumb is lateral, your little finger is medial. All right, so the bone that is lateral is called the radius right here. So this bone that matches up with the thumb is the radius. You got another one called the ulna, that's medial. All right, so you got radius and ulna. And look at some of these structures on this medial bone. Let me see what the next picture looks like. Oh, yeah. Here is the medial bone. Let me go back. Here's the medial bone. That's the ulna. Let's look at the proximal part of the ulna, and look, it forms like this hook right here. All right, this superior part is called the olecranon process. All right, what's that function of the olecranon process? Muscle attachment. All right, and the triceps actually inserts into the olecranon process that allows you to extend your arm. And there's another little process called the coronoid process here and here. And let's look over at this diagram right here. So here is the trochlea, here is the capitulum, and notice that the olecranon process kind of wraps around the trochlea posteriorly and wraps around anteriorly via the coronoid process right here. And so the elbow joint with the ulna and the humerus is just purely a hinge joint. It can just go flex and extend. That's all that joint can do. All right, so you got to see how that fits together. Let me see what this other slide looks like. Okay, so here you see the olecranon process, here you see the coronoid process, and you see a big notch between them. All right, so we named that notch after the articulating surface that's in the distal part of the humerus. What was that called? That's the trochlea. So here's that trochlea. It fits into the trochlear notch of the ulna. All right, so what is that anterior? Here's the anterior process on the ulna, all right, the coronoid process. So when you flex your forearm, that bony process has to fit someplace into the humerus. Let's see where it fits. And guess what we would call that? Okay, so we're going to be looking at what the anterior side of the humerus, when we flex the forearm, that coronoid process, has got to fit into this depression right here. And we call that the coronoid fossa. All right, and when we extend the forearm, there is a big bony massive prominence on the posterior ulna that has to fit into a depression in the humerus. That's called what? That's the olecranon process right there. So it fits into the olecranon fossa in the posterior part of the humerus right here. All right, so that's the level at which you got to appreciate, right, this elbow joint. And we're not done yet with it. Because we haven't talked about the capitulum. We talked about the trochlea. All right, so what bone articulates with the trochlea right here? It is the lateral one, the ulna. Namely what? The olecranon process and the cornoid process forming the trochlear notch. And then can you see that this is lateral? Could you look up over here? The capitulum is lateral. So what bone articulates with the capitulum? That's going to be the radius. All right, so the radius right here. The head of the radius, all right, is nice and round. You can see it nice and round right over here. And there's an articulating surface that is a nice simple facet at the head of the radius that articulates with this ball right here. This is the capitulum. So the radius can act as a hinge joint as well. But the radius can also pivot. Because look at the shape of the head of the radius. It is what? It's nice and round. It can pivot as it's articulating with the capitulum. And the radius can actually cross over the ulna when it pivots. All right, it crosses over. So the head of the radius also has to articulate with the ulna right here. So if you were to take this ulna away and take a look at it, and put your, so here is the olecranon process, here's the cornoid process, and put your finger right here, what are you going to feel? You're going to feel a depression, but it's going to be a nice smooth depression because this is where the head of the radius articulates with that proximal part of the ulna. Right? It will rotate. It will just pivot right here. So this is the ulna, and we call that the radial notch. So make sure you can actually palpate that thing in lab, radial notch. That's something I think some students forget to look at sometimes. Now if we look at the distal joint between the ulna and radius, all right, so here is, so here is the distal part of the radius. This is the distal part of the ulna right here. And notice that the head of the ulna is kind of round and smooth as well, and it fits into a corresponding notch in this distal part of the radius. And so this is what we call the ulnar notch. Right, that corresponds to the radial notch at the proximal part of the ulna right here, so that the radius can actually cross over the ulna. And we're going to learn what that motion is called a little bit later. Okay, not today. All right, there's a membrane. There's a special joint between the ulna and radius, and that membrane is called the interosseous membrane. Whenever you see that osseous, what should you think of? Or osteo, you should think of bone. All right, so here is a membrane between the two bones of your forearm.
What is the function?
It's a ligament. It's a highly movable ligamentous joint. There aren't too many joints made out of ligaments that are movable, but that one is. That one is fairly movable. Okay, so I think we're pretty much done with the humerus and the radius and ulna. Guess what the name of that artery is that's going down right over here? Yeah, the radial artery. Okay.
What does the ulna articulate with on the humerus?
The ulna? Ah, okay. The ulna, as it articulates with the bone superior to it, okay, the ulna articulates with the trochlea, and the radius articulates with the capitulum. Okay, and the capitulum kind of looks like a ball. The trochlea looks like a bobbin or a spool that you would wind some thread up on. Okay. All right. All right, so I'll tell you some good news about the wrist. We still got a couple minutes left. That clock's a little slow, so we'll get out of here on time. All right, the wrist. Look at all those bones in the wrist. And you have to know that all of these bones in the wrist right here are called carpals. But you don't have to know each one by name. All right, you do have to know one. You have to know this one right here. What's the name of that one? That's the scaphoid. What can you tell me about the scaphoid compared to, for instance, the trapezium here and the hamate right here? What does that shape look like? What does it look like compared to those other bones of the wrist? It looks like it's really thin and narrow in places. And you know what? When somebody breaks a wrist when they fall, that's the bone that almost always breaks, the scaphoid. Because why? It's really thin in locations. And when that bone breaks, it damages the blood vessels that are going to it. So tell me about how well that bone heals if you damage the blood vessel. You know what? A blood vessel might not ever repair itself, and the scaphoid then is going to be forever atrophied. It won't regenerate itself. So that person will have kind of strange motion in the wrist after that. So all of these eight bones right here you're going to call carpals. Carpals are bones of the, I don't want you to say hand. It's close to the hand, but it's actually your wrist. Your hand is a little bit different. Okay. Which of those bones is most easily fractured? It's a scaphoid, right? Okay. Now, bones of the hand. Bones of the hand are what we call metacarpals right here. So wrist is different than the hand. How many metacarpals do you have?
Five.
You have five, right? In your hand and your foot, it's the same. Not all mammals are like that, but for us, we got five and five. And they're just named. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, starting with the thumb. So here's the first metacarpal. Second, third, fourth, fifth. These are all just metacarpals. They make up your hand. Okay, they make up your hand. So you got wrist, you got hand, and then you got digits. you got digits. And you've got some bones in the digits. Most digits have three, and each one of these bones are called phalanges. Okay, and they're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But you can see in the digit number 2, you've got three bones, so this is the number 2 proximal phalanx, because those are all phalanges. The bones of your fingers are phalanges. Here's number 2 proximal, number 2 middle, number 2 distal. All right, so when it comes time to take the practicum, you shouldn't get any of this wrong, but you got to really look and be careful and make sure you know which one is which. And you always start counting with the hitchhiker digit. Yeah. When someone has polydactyly, how does that happen? It's inherited. I don't know, there might be some environmental chemicals that can produce that, but it's usually inherited. And it's usually, I think it's fairly common in, I don't know what the ancestry, but in Amish people in Pennsylvania have that gene that really runs through their families. It's fairly common where they have polydactyly that runs in the family. But I don't know where they came. Is that Dutch? Maybe it's a Dutch, some kind of Central European heritage. Yeah. And before you go, one last question.
The first phalange is a number 2 proximal.
This right here?
Yeah.
Number 2 proximal. Number 2 middle. And then number 2 distal. All right? All right, so I'll finish up here. No, I'll start here next time.